Music, among other things.
Music among other things.
Hey everyone, I'm Sean.
And I'm Neil.
Welcome to Music Among Other Things, or MAOT for short, where we chat to musicians and creators about music and the worlds that orbit. And we've got a very special episode today where we're going to be getting deep into some stats. So, Neil, who are we talking to?
Yeah, so we've got a chart analyst on today. So we've got James Masterton. He's chart analyst at Music Week magazine. Recently took over last year from the legendary columnist Alan Jones. But yeah, he's everything charts. If you need someone, anyone for charts, he's your guy. Yeah, I guess the thing that interests me most about the chart world is, you know, the trends, because sometimes you get these random ass songs come back into the charts and there seems to be absolutely no reason for it. And so I guess part of his job, for what we will find out hopefully, is looking into those trends. You know, was it in like some sort of media or a TikTok video or what? So there must be so many interesting things that you can't really predict. It's more like you're kind of just looking at the world and judging for yourself. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it can be so random, can't it? And you know, James himself, he's been running his own blog called Chart Watch since basically the 90s. Like, I think we can even go back to like the week we were born in on his blog, which is like totally insane. We're going to be talking to him a little bit about Taylor Swift's strategy to re-record Fearless and the bout she's been having there. Also, it's worth saying what got us to this in the first place is when there was a news that broke a fair few weeks ago now about The Killers having 10 years in the top 100 in the UK, which is really a proper marathon in terms of people from and bands from their particular era. We're also going to be talking to James a little bit about the long runners in the charts. People like Fleetwood Mac rumours are still in like the sort of 40s and 60s in the charts, so it'd be interesting to see what the patterns are there too. And obviously, Neil, your girl Olivia Rodrigo is doing very well in the charts.
My girl. Yeah, she's absolutely smashing it. So I think she's got 3 songs in the top 5, like 1, 4, and 5 or something.
Mad.
And I'd like to think I've probably contributed to 50% of those listens.
I think so. But,
Maybe. But so you're welcome, Olivia.
All right, cool. Well, without further ado, Neil, shall we get into it?
Let's do it.
So, James, thanks so much for joining us on MAOT. And obviously, James is a chart analyst for Music Week. So I think that's been since around March 2020. Is that right?
Yeah, just over a year and a month. First of all, thank you for inviting me into your virtual space. But yeah, I dove into this at the worst possible time, or the best possible time, depending on your point of view. I literally worked for Music Week for all of 1 week before the whole world went to crap and they closed the offices. And so I'm basically writing for people who I've never actually met or interacted with in any other sense other than over email. But so far, it all seems to be working okay. But yes, for what was going to be just a few weeks before everything returned to normal has now turned into a year. And I'm still waiting to actually get to see them in the offices.
Yeah, I'm in a sort of similar situation with my day job. Yeah, it's I just joined a new place and it's just very odd. You can't really put a face to the email or the
That must be the worst thing in the world, mustn't it? To join a new team of people in air quotes and not actually be able to interact with them beyond on a screen. Yeah, I can't imagine how that's working for people, but a lot of people have done it.
No, it's very odd. But it's interesting to see that. Obviously, I know you've been working for Music Week, you know, for the past year. But you've been running your own chart update and been writing for other places for a very long time. So it'd be interesting to know how you got into this trade, because obviously it's a very like niche area of journalism.
I mean, I've been saying to people that I kind of auditioned for this job for 25 years. And so it's good that my patience has finally been rewarded. But it wasn't until the internet came along that it became possible to work out just how many people like me there were. And I use that word hesitantly, like me, because you find when you gather together in a space occupied by a lot of chart enthusiasts, they all seem to be these very intense, socially awkward men. that have found some kind of solace in delving into statistics. Hey, if the cap fits, wear it, as they say. I always grew up having this fascination for the pop charts, even predating my actual interest in pop music. And I always say it's my mum and dad's fault, because even though they weren't necessarily all that interested in pop music, they would at least tape things off the radio, so we had tapes to play in the car when we went away on continental holidays. And so that was always, back in the early 1980s, Tony Blackburn presenting the chart show. And then as I grew older and actually started to get into music myself, I loved the whole idea of the Top 40 show on the weekend. That was always my favorite radio show. It was always a genuine tuning point, and it was one of the reasons why I actually wanted to become a radio presenter myself in the first place, so I could get to present the chart show one day. That was the sum total of my ambition. And I, of course, devoured all the chart books when they came out. The day I first discovered Guinness British Hit Singles on the shelf in the school library, I think it was, was again one of the greatest moments of my life, because I just spent the next week studying that in every detail. And I love the way it actually allowed pop music history to unfold before your eyes. So even if you didn't actually know what the records were or didn't know the significance of the artist in question, you could actually see what significance they'd had and what impact they'd made on popular culture. And the historian in me actually loved that aspect of it. And so, of course, the next watershed moment was discovering the old music magazine Record Mirror for the first time, because in the back of that, every week was this column by this man called Alan Jones, who appeared to have the same fascination that I did, because he wrote an entire article about what was happening in the charts this week, why this song was number one, how long it had been at number one, what significance there was of that. And so that was the revelation that there was this whole world of statistics and knowledge and records that you could track and you could pay attention to. And it was a subject that had fascinated me. The whole circumstances of me doing it online came when I first got online in the early 1990s, when I was at university and started reading the old Usenet newsgroups, which was the forerunner of today's forums, except it was just text-based posting, and you chose the board for your topic of choice and you read about it. And what I discovered was there was communities devoted to music, by and large populated by American people, because that was where most internet connectivity was in those days. If you went to an American university, you generally by default had internet connectivity. And whenever people posted up the lists of the British charts, there were always lots of questions. Why is this there? Why is this happening? I remember the particular moment. It was October 1992 when the old Simple Minds song Alive and Kicking was back in the charts. And so a lot of Americans were questioning this. Well, didn't this come out in 1985? Why on earth is it in the British top 10 in 1992? The answer was actually fairly simple. There was a Simple Minds Greatest Hits collection out. It had been re-released because of that. And it was being used by Sky Sports to promote the Premier League coverage.
Right.
Perfect synergy there. And that was why it came back in the charts. And it suddenly occurred to me, well, hang on, there is a gap there. This is my opportunity to contribute, to sit and explain what is happening about these records, why they're in the charts. And so as a result of that, I started writing these pieces and posting them online every single week. And from then, I kind of just stepped into to different realms. The few years later, because I carried on doing this even after I graduated from university, and that just happened to coincide with the domestic internet revolution. So, of course, that was the point when everybody was getting online at home. And so I was already one of the superstars of the UK writing. And so when, as it so turned out, Music Week magazine decided they were going to have a web presence of their own, and they stumbled across me. And first of all, it was the people that were in charge of the charts at the time said, no, hang on, that's our copyright. You shouldn't be doing that. But then the editor of Music Week said, well, actually, this guy's got an inbuilt audience that we can bring to our brand new website along the way. So he called me into his office and said, okay, how would you like to write this piece for us every single week?
And awesome.
I carried on doing that through various formats across different sites until gradually economics took over and it no longer became viable for anybody to run a music website. And I ran out of people who were paying me to do it, carried on doing it anyway for my own websites. And before I knew it, Music Week are getting in touch and saying, right, Alan Jones, the man who I first started reading back in the 1980s, who'd actually been doing it since the late 1970s, has decided to retire, and we need someone to replace him.
Yeah.
It's been suggested to us that you're the man to do it.
Was there a sort of a passing of the torch moment between you and Alan? I like the idea that there would be.
Yeah.
It would have been nice to have actually met him, but hey, circumstances dictated otherwise. I'd corresponded with him on one or two occasions in the past, mainly on the occasion when he had cause to be grumpy because I'd made a glaring error and people assumed it was him. And so he was wanting to me to kind of set the record straight and make that corrected. So I've always had this kind of fractious relationship with him, and I was always conscious as well that I was kind of copying what he was doing, because one of the sources of material I had for my own pieces were the things he was writing in his column. And I was what made sure that I always acknowledged any bit of information that I'd got directly from him rather than trying to pass it off as my own research. I was always very nervous about doing that. But no, I wrote a piece paying tribute to him when he retired and when he left, and explaining the significance of what he'd done over the past 30 years or so. 40 years, in fact, it was. And said, you know, it's a great honour to be doing it. And I got a very nice note back from him thanking me for taking the time to pay tribute, and also correcting one or two errors of judgment I'd made during the course of the piece.
So thank very, you, very but... him.
So it still doesn't necessarily feel real, because he was the man who always said had forgotten more than I'd ever learned about the history of the charts and what was significant and what wasn't. And so every single week when I submit the piece, I have this strange feeling of imposter syndrome that I'm really just pretending to be the person who knows what they're talking about. But I'm sure I'll get over that in about 5 or 6 years if they still let me do it in that time.
Oh, that's excellent to hear. Because, it seems like you've been obviously tracking the charts in a period where there's been the most change really with streaming, and it'd be great to get into that in a bit. But I think, first of all, I mean, one of the things that got us onto this topic of, you know, looking into the charts and chart analysis is the news of The Killers chart run in the top 100 for Mr. Brightside, and the fact that it had been in the top 100 for a 5-year period. Because it seems like still that's quite a recent song to have done that. And I know within the album charts themselves, there's a lot of greatest hits too. But I mean, what in terms of like news like that, is that, I guess that's quite big in you know, your world. Is that
it
right?
It has been a great time to be looking at the charts and tracking how things have changed. And certainly that hit home to me when I was building my own personal archive of material, because I'd kept copies of everything I'd written, but they'd never actually been online other than when they were, the week they were published. So when the time came for me to set up my own site, I figured the unique selling point of it was going to be, let's put up the entire archive. And in order to do that, I had to read through week by week everything I'd ever written. And wow. In doing that, I know it was quite a burden, let me tell you. But in the course of doing that, I became conscious that actually this was a fantastic, exciting roller coaster of seeing these historical changes developing and unfolding month by month, year by year, and the way the music industry has become dramatically transformed. I started doing this right at the point when vinyl singles were starting to die off and the CD single revolution kicked in a little bit later than it should have done, but suddenly took over as the primary means of consumption. And so to live through the period as well when suddenly that dies away and everybody moves over to downloading, and just when downloading has become established as the way to consume music, online streaming comes along and blows all that away as well. So yeah, the opportunity has been there for a great many new records to be set and strange different things to happen. And of course, what we've seen along the way is the limits on the shelf life of songs now melting away. Because of course, once upon a time, when it was a case of physical products, there was always a point where everybody who wanted a copy of a particular song had actually bought it. And there was a point where shops themselves had no real need to keep stocks of these records in, because they wanted to clear the shelves out of the way for new material, which was going to be more popular. But of course, when you hit the digital age, there comes a point when songs and records can linger around forever. And we did see that the moment downloads first started to be counted for the charts. There were one or two songs which, for whatever reason, caught hold of the public imagination and just kept on selling. Low numbers all the time, but in sufficient numbers to ensure they hung around on the charts for far, far longer than might otherwise have been the case. Mm. And then, yeah, you hit Mr. Brightside by The Killers, which is a strange curiosity. Mm. I've had people in the past say to me, what's the reason for this? Why has this song, more than any others of its era, just endured and been so popular across what is now almost two decades? And whenever I'm asked that question, I always say, I've no bloody idea. No idea whatsoever. Because it's very, very odd. It was their second single, their first to actually become a proper chart hit in this country, made the top 10 very, very briefly, at the very briefest of chart runs. It was only in the charts for 4 weeks at the time. And this was actually in 2004, prior to the download era kicking in. Mm. But then the moment a download of a song became eligible for the chart, irrespective of whether it was tied to a physical product, Mr. Brightside suddenly made a chart return and started to hang around the very lower end of the charts. And it's carried on doing that ever since. It might go away for a few weeks, and then a month or so later, it'll come back, and you can scroll down the official charts website, the full list of its chart runs, and you see, you know, it's there for a number of weeks in 07, and then in 08, and then for a bit in 09, and then 10, and so on and so on. And then, of course, we hit the streaming era, and it kicks back into life again, because, of course, you know, there did come a point when everybody who wanted to own a download, an MP3 copy of Mr. Brightside, had actually done so. So it started to fade away. But of course, it makes its way into streaming playlists. And it's been a near constant presence in the charts ever since around about 2017. As to why that is, I don't know. And I'm sure it baffles The Killers as well, because even they would acknowledge it's, you know, it's a concert favorite. It's certainly a staple of their back catalogue. It's by no means the best song they ever recorded. I've never actually seen an interview with Brandon Flowers where he is spoken about the enduring appeal of Mr. Brightside. It just seems to be one of those easy-to-learn songs, the one you can actually yell along to almost as if it's a football chant without necessarily needing to worry about the melody.
My theory is that maybe it comes about every December when The Holiday plays on repeats for the Christmas films, and there's that one scene of Cameron Diaz shouting in that little cottage. Maybe it's a yearly trend of a Christmas film that just gets played every year.
There could be that as well, although it seems to be in summertime when it actually come for a wander around the charts. But there are strange little cultural reference points. I think the first time I ever became aware that it was a touchstone for some people. Do you remember the fly on the wall TV show, The Call Centre, which was, was a BBC 3 or BBC 4 show, where it was a fly on the wall documentary about this call centre in Wales, in Cardiff or Swansea or somewhere like that, and run by this very strange, charismatic man who was an odd David Brent style manager. But his philosophy was, you're employing these people very often on very low wages and putting them in a point position where they're actually going to be abused by people constantly because they're ringing them up cold calling, trying to sell them things. The only way they can deal with that is to be relentlessly, joyfully happy. So part of his initiation of any new recruits was to gather them all in a conference room and say, right, we're all going to sing Mr. Brightside by The Killers. And it was not insignificant that the song made its way back into the charts and actually far higher up the charts than it had done for some time after the airing of that series. Wow. As if it was indicating to people that actually your love of this song is quite valid. Because it is loved by other people. And again, it didn't strike you as the kind of song that everybody would necessarily know the words, but all of these people in this room did know the words and joyfully got up and belted it out and bellowed along. So for some reason, it has this strange resonance with the British public. And so over the course of the past few years, it has notched up enough chart weeks that so much so that if you view the top 100 as the ultimate reference point for the length of the charts, it's had more weeks on the top 100 than any other song in chart history. And it's still there today in the week we are recording this. It's still there in the top 100 because enough people are streaming it. It's very, very odd.
I mean, it was always coming on when you and me, Sean, were at university. It's like the last, you know, one of the last songs along with like Wonderwall, Don't Look Back in Anger, that people want to hear before they go. And they're getting a bit teary-eyed and stuff because it's like 3 a.m., the end of the night. But it's still the case now if you go like clubbing now. It's the one of those last songs that comes on.
It's very much a belted out 3 a.m. anthem that's one resonating in your ears as you're queuing up for your coats again.
Yeah, exactly.
But the fact that it's carried on in the past year, even when no one's actually been able to go to clubs, indicates people that do still have a love for it. So, so to summarise the too long didn't read version of this, why is Mr. Brightside by The Killers the longest charting song in British chart history? I have absolutely no idea, but it's one of those self-perpetuating things. It stays on streaming playlists, and it's one of those songs that people don't necessarily have the urge to skip. Oh yeah, Mr. Brightside, I'll sit and listen to that. So of course it gets a play, and the more plays you get, the higher up the charts you end.
So does that maybe a stupid question for me, so with the what counts as a play, is it like after a minute, or is it a full song, or just for
it
people that might not know?
It is 30 seconds. You have to listen to a song for at least 30 seconds in order for it to register as a play. And it's become quite interesting. There's a lot of musicologists that have analysed the way pop songs were constructed in the past and the way they are constructed now. And there is very much a focus on getting to the meat of the song as soon as possible to hook people in.
Yeah.
You'll notice most modern pop songs don't have very lengthy intros. The idea that, you know, you'd end up tinkling away and building a theme, building a melody for around 15-20 seconds, that's completely gone. Because if you've gone 15-20 seconds without actually getting to the meat of the song, the more chances there are for people to go, now this is boring, and click through, and you've actually lost the play. And whilst that doesn't count for the charts as a result, but crucially it doesn't trigger a royalty payment, because again, the likes of Spotify and Deezer and what have you only actually pay royalties for a play if a song has been streamed for longer than 30 seconds. So composers are very focused on that idea and actually banging in, sometimes with a chorus straight away, the moment the song starts, just to hook you in, simply so you're guaranteed that 30 seconds.
Interesting. I think another thing we've been looking at recently is obviously Taylor Swift's strategy with creating her own version of Fearless, or she's going to be going through her first six albums anyway to do that. I mean, I know it's only her second week it's been out, the Taylor's version for Fearless, and that was number one the week prior to this one. But I think I've seen it's dropped like to number seven now. Just wondering what your thoughts are on like that strategy and what you foresee. Do you feel like that would ever truly take over the original version? Because it's a very interesting way she's doing it. I feel like nobody's done it before, but you might be able to correct me otherwise.
It's certainly fairly unique in terms of making a note for note cover of your own record, and I think everybody knows the circumstances behind her doing this. Of course, the idea is not necessarily for the album to become a hit. I mean, at the end of the day, something like Fearless, it's one she made 12 years ago. It doesn't even represent the style of music she makes these days. So the aim actually isn't necessarily for it to sell in large numbers and to make her lots of money along the way. What she is wanting to do is wrestle back the rights to the music, and in particular the sync rights, because what she's been doing is blocking the use of a lot of these older songs in things like adverts and movie soundtracks and the kind of thing that's outside of radio play, because she doesn't want the people who own the rights to those recordings to make any money out of it. So these are brand new recordings that she does own the rights to, that she can now release and now allow people to use. That's her primary aim. The challenge was, of course, to try and make sure that it did eclipse the original version. And it was quite fascinating. When she first released the single, the Taylor's version of Love Story, you actually had to jump through hoops to listen to it, particularly on smart speakers. If you were talking to Amazon Echoes. And I found that a lot when, you know, I wanted to play this in the kitchen and hear the new version of Taylor Swift's Love Story. And I tied myself in knots trying to get my Echo speaker to actually play me the new version. Because every time you told it, you know, play Love Story by Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
It went for the original, which was all well and good. They did sound identical after all. Mm. But of course, you got the feeling, well, hang on, that's not actually what she wants.
Yeah.
And I noticed earlier today, because I tested it out before coming here, that somebody's clearly thrown a switch somewhere or made an adjustment to the algorithms. So now if you ask for Love Story by Taylor Swift or indeed any of the tracks off Fearless, by default, Amazon is playing you the Taylor's version tracks.
Oh, interesting.
So it actually does seem to have had an effect. And that's what she wants. She wants to make the old version completely obsolete. So any plays, any use of any of these songs, they're done using the versions she has control of. So it was actually an extraordinary thing that it did actually make it to the top of the charts, something the original album hadn't actually done because it, of course, predated her mainstream superstardom. And it's actually very impressive that it's stayed in the top 10 for a second week because not many albums that made it to the top of the charts have done that lately for a whole variety of other reasons. So, yeah, it's going to add to her album sales overall, but yeah, the aim is not necessarily for it to sell and perform in the charts. What she's just wanting to do is wipe the originals from history, and by the looks of things, that's been very successful so far, and it bodes well for when she moves on to some of her later material, which of course is the bigger stuff and the stuff that was massive worldwide hits along the way. The groundwork has been done, making it easier, I think, for her to replace the original versions with these newer versions.
Yeah,
awesome. Because, I mean, it's good to hear the algorithms are working in her favor now as well, because I know I read a few articles where fans have said, you know, real hardcore fans have said, yeah, we're sacrificing the old version now. We're going to give it one more listen at midnight, and then from midnight onwards, we're going to be listening to the new. But they're so obviously so dedicated, so it's good that it's working in their favour. But
We are.
Well, exactly. But
there is nothing stranger than online fandom and the way they will want to make their public demonstrations of faith.
Oh, yeah.
But yes, I guess good for them. But that they want to attract her love. They want her to appreciate them.
Yeah.
And what better way of doing it than saying, right, we are going to disavow this record that we bought a decade ago and only focus on this new version.
Yeah.
Just for you, Tay-Tay. That's how much we love you.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was wondering if we could pick up one of the points you just said there. You mentioned about the fact that albums have been released and they've been dropping out of the top spot quite sharply. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. This has been a strange phenomenon.
Yeah.
We are in the middle of the most unprecedented run in albums chart history, because since the middle of last summer, when ironically the last album to do so was Taylor Swift's Folklore, the last album to actually stay at number one for more than a week at a time. Since the release of that album, no record has had more than 1 week at number one. So we're now into 30 odd different weeks where the number one album has changed hands each time. But not only that, the vast majority of them, and certainly the vast majority of albums this year, have been very much front-loaded one-week wonders. So a number one album will fly straight into the top of the charts, sell a large number of copies, but then very, very few later on. So we've actually had all-time records being broken. Never before had any album outside of Christmas enter the charts at number one and drop completely out of the top 100 altogether. But that's now happened on a couple of occasions in the last couple of months alone, which indicates there's something very odd going on with the market. And I think it's a consequence of this latest coronavirus lockdown we had at the start of the year. When the first one happened a year ago, the record industry wasn't prepared for this.
Yeah.
And so its normal means of distribution was suddenly taken away because much of the focus was on getting albums into stores where people could wander in and find them and discover them and buy them. And as a result of extended periods of music stores being closed, they've had to switch focus far, far more than they always used to do to what they call now the DTF sales, the direct to fan sales, where you order your music online on the artist's website, and that's posted out to you on the dates released. And so as a result, albums are posting very, very large numbers of sales almost the moment they're released. I mean, for example, the week we're talking now, London Grammar are number one on the album chart.
Yeah.
It was always obvious they were going to be number one on the album chart when on their very first day on the Friday, they apparently sold 20,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they hadn't sold 20,000 copies. They just had 20,000 people pre-order the album. And that was the point in which they were delivered. Now, that's great because it means you can get the music into the hands of people who want it. What's missing, what's not happening, is the subsequent discovery. Because, of course, you would release your album. It would do very well in the first week. And then it would be racked prominently in a record store. And people would discover it that way. Come along, see it there. That seems to be popular. Let's take a listen to it. Let's buy that as well. And you've got this extra discovery. That bit of the ecosystem has sadly gone missing. And I think people are hoping against hope that it's going to come back. And that's why we're seeing this phenomenon of you are selling a brand new album to your dedicated fan base, the people you are focused on marketing it to. But then you're struggling to put it onto anybody else.
Right, yeah, that makes sense.
And this is a head-scratcher because it makes it very difficult to break new artists. I mean, looking at the singles chart at the moment, the hottest new artist at the moment, and quite rightly so because he's a fantastic performer, is Tom Grennan, who's got two top 10 singles at the moment. And when his album Evering Road came out, it was in huge demand. It flew to the top of the charts. But this was also one of those albums that then dropped completely out of the top 100 next week because it sold to people who wanted the Tom Grennan album but didn't sell to anybody else.
Right, yeah.
This is now an issue. This guy's got top 10 singles. You'd think there are people who would be interested to hear some of his other tracks. But, of course, at the moment, there's no means of putting that album on display to people to allow them to find it, to allow them to discover it. And it's the bit the record industry is having to deal with at the moment and work out a new way of persuading people to discover stuff that's already out.
So is it almost, I guess, the big thing for artists these days then, I imagine, is getting onto these, you know, Spotify playlists, what they release weekly or monthly of new music. And I don't know how that's ranked. Is that based on purely like commercially, or is it based on, I really don't have a clue, but I imagine that's a big thing.
The core playlists on streaming services like Spotify's New Music Friday, they're actually being manually curated. So there are people whose job it is to put those together. And obviously behind the scenes, there is clearly a lot of lobbying going on. And to people, labels, trying to ensure they have a prominence there. And I mean, Spotify and the other services like it do work very hard to try and create a shop window environment. So they will come to arrangements with record labels that, right, this week we're going to do a promotion for this particular act. So you will see the brand new album from a high priority act as one of the first things you see when you open the app. So they are actually doing the same kind of job that high street record stores always used to do, and only theoretically will do when everything finally creeps back towards normal and people get back in the habit of buying and going to record shops, presuming they do. But yeah, it's an all part of the evolution of the way music is being presented and the way everyone in the record industry has had to learn new ways of promoting music. And the fact that this social change, which was happening quite gradually, has suddenly been forced in a whole new direction by the fact that we all ended up in lockdown, the shops were closed, and everything has had to migrate online, has actually accelerated that change in so many ways. And it has left holes in the marketing. It's left holes in the creativity. People are having to come up with different ways of promoting records and extend their lifespan. Some artists have actually managed to do that, but not everybody's picked up the trick.
And for someone like you, Percy, as like an A-lister in this, you know, chart world, do you like that, how much it's changing and how kind of interesting it's becoming? Or is it something that it's making you realize, I don't know, more nostalgia from how it used to be?
I encounter a lot of people who are dedicated chart fans, and there are a great many of them online, and they, of course, contact me all the time. There seems to be this strange subset of people who are not necessarily pop music fans, but fans of the charts themselves. So they will still obsess over chart positions and how things are behaving without necessarily being bothered about how the music sounds. And a lot of those are quite traditionalists with very strong, strident views as to the way things should be. Even 6 years after streams were introduced, you will get people insisting that streams have no business being counted for the charts whatsoever, and it should really only count people who are putting down money for it. I try and rise above that. I see my job as being the guy who's there to observe things and see what's happening and see how it's developing. I'm in a privileged position as well that I get to talk to the people on the other side of the coin, the people within the industry. So I know record PRs and record pluggers, and I know the work they do behind the scenes to make records happen. And of course, I know the thought processes are going on in terms of how the charts can evolve and how things can change. And what you have to remember is, although you've got official charts themselves who are the public face of the charts and the people that actually publish them and own them, they are always at pains to stress that they don't unilaterally make any decisions. There is a committee of interested parties, largely made up of representatives from the music industry, from the labels, from the streaming services, who all actually come to a consensus as to how these listings should be put together. And they are constantly asking questions and trying to work out ways to wander through this brand new world, because things have changed dramatically in a way no one would expect it. Because, of course, the minute you start counting streaming, you're breaking the historic link between a physical conscious purchase and a chart position. We're no longer cataloguing the discovery of music. We're actually cataloguing consumption. And that's actually a very different beast. And so inevitably, things have changed. And that's why you see the charts behave in a dramatically different way before. There is always a finite limit to how many people are available to discover a piece of music and like it so much they want to pay money for it. The amount of time people will want to spend appreciating and listening to a piece of music is actually far, far longer. And that's why the biggest hits have such a long shelf life. But it means we've had to adjust our perceptions as to the way the charts should behave and what they should look like, and indeed how they represent the popularity of newer music rather than music that's been around for a few months, or even like the Killers that's been around for almost two decades.
Yeah, that's interesting, because obviously that change also from somebody working within the industry or a record label. Obviously, I know there's ways that people have thought of how to game the streaming system. For instance, I was looking at this about how longer albums tend to do better in terms of charting. I was wondering, could you give us any insight into things of that nature, as in how actual record labels are maybe trying to improve their chances of charting in this new world? Yeah. Or have you got any insight?
It's a learning curve for absolutely everybody. It's actually very interesting. The whole idea of how long an album should be, as we all know, have changed. Where once upon a time, the focus was all killer, no filler. And of course, there was a physical limit to how many tracks you could actually fit on a disc.
Yeah.
You're no longer constrained by that. And so you have artists like Drake who will spend 3 months in the studio and just dump out there every single note they've recorded just to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And of course, different countries have different regulations. I think still in America on the Billboard 200 chart, they don't pay any mind as to how many tracks there are on an album. They count all the streams regardless. And that's why for a lot of American artists, there has been this tendency to go for more tracks. So you simply can accumulate the numbers of streams.
Right.
I don't think it necessarily works out that way, because there's only so many hours in a day you have to spend listening to songs by your favorite artist. And so as a result, if anything, it actually makes people tired of what you're hearing. The British charts, when they started counting streams towards the album charts, did take a view that, no, we're only going to track the most popular tracks from an album. So in terms of working out the numbers for the album charts at the moment, they're counting the cumulative total of the 12 most popular tracks on an album. Any of the others are simply disregarded.
So it's a cut-off at 12 tracks, is it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Interesting.
And so that actually helps. That prevents artists like Drake, or I think Zayn Malik is another one who's released 27 track albums, that prevents them trying to have that kind of inbuilt advantage and forces labels to focus on, right, let's make sure people stream the most popular ones as much as possible, as much as they can. And you're seeing people trying different ways because, of course, again, once upon a time, an album was an artistic statement in itself, and it was very easy to make that artistic statement within 9, 10 or 12 tracks. Much, much harder if you're talking 25. And it was fascinating to see when Taylor Swift brought out Folklore last summer, which again was another behemoth. They were about 23, 24 tracks on that.
Yeah.
And she put that out in the first instance, but then over the next few weeks, divided it into chapters and released a series of themed playlists saying, okay, these tracks are telling this story, these tracks are telling this story, these tracks are telling this story, and encouraging people to focus on those particular chunks, which was actually very clever, because not only did it encourage appreciation of all the tracks of the album as a whole in a manner that you might not have done so if you were just listening to them all in one go, but it meant she spread out over a number of weeks the focus on the album. And that played into the hands of charts like the British charts, where they're only calculating the most popular tracks. So if you select 8 to focus on this week and another 8 to focus on the next week and another 8 to focus on the following week, you're actually extending the chart life of your album and increasing its chart sales along the way. And I think that's one of the reasons why it was unique in most albums in the past year or so, that it actually spent a month at the top of the charts because she put all that hard work in.
Yeah, and like you say, it adds weighting to some of those songs that you might have just skipped 14 to 17, whatever. It adds weighting and meaning to those songs now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's not necessarily appreciated. And I think most people looking at the listings casually aren't necessarily going to appreciate. But there's this strange opacity in the way streams are calculated towards the albums. It gets very, very complicated because, yes, you're counting cumulatively the total number of streams for all of the tracks on the album, or at least all the ones that count. But then what you're doing is downweighting the most popular two, because what they didn't want to happen as well was to have an album with one massive hit single that was skewing its album's performance. If people are only listening to this one particular track, they're not necessarily listening to the whole of the rest of the album, so there's no reason why that one track should drag it up the album's chart. So as a result, the two most popular tracks on an album are downgraded to the average of all the rest.
It's so difficult, isn't it? There's always going to be some sort of compromise on
indeed,
people
yeah.
opposing it. It's but, so you know, hard.
Try and explain that to people. That's the way it works. It's best really to gloss over it and say, right, yeah, the album sold X amount as a result of the streams. Deal with that.
In terms of, because I know one of the areas we wanted to talk about was sort of long players in the charts or albums or particular songs that have been there for a long time, like The Killers. And I was wondering if there's been a pattern where that happened more regularly at one point, or whether that's a sort of a dying art. Just because I was even looking just today, and I saw albums like AM by Arctic Monkeys, which was out in 2013, nearly like 8 years ago. Now that's at number 24 this week. The first Arctic Monkeys album is at number 49. So there are like these certain pockets of artists or albums that are sticking around. And I'm aware that also Fleetwood Mac's Rumours, that pops up into charts quite regularly. I know, particularly off the back of that TikTok trend. But in terms of these long stays in the charts, do you think that is still going to continue to happen? Are we still going to see maybe albums released in the last 4 years remain or climb up the charts? Or is that just dependent on what might be happening in culture in general?
It's fascinating to see that this has actually remained the case, because there was always the chance it wouldn't. I mean, going back in albums chart history, there have always been the long runners, the albums that have sold in large numbers over a very long period of time and put together some quite epic chart runs. And they, you know, the obvious candidates like Rumours by Fleetwood Mac, which was always, even before the streaming era, one of the most charted albums of all time in this country. Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf, Greatest Hits by Queen, Gold by ABBA. Those were the ones that had charted for the longest time simply because they remained on the shelves and people always seemed to have the money available to actually buy them. Mm. It's interesting that as sales of catalog albums have dropped away and people have now been able to stream all these classic songs, that the albums have maintained this position of being able to loiter for long periods at a time. Mm. And I think it's because streaming is now rewarding those albums which have a large number of popular tracks. Mm. And it's all down to this algorithm that I mentioned just before, where the most popular two tracks on the album are downgraded to the average of all the rest. Mm. Now, that actually counts against a brand new album by an up-and-coming artist, which may pop a first week as a result of the one hit single they've got. Mm. But of course, if the rest of the tracks aren't actually being streamed in very large numbers in the following weeks, then all of those streams for the big hit actually count for very, very little. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't actually make the chart impact. Something like Rumours by Fleetwood Mac or Greatest Hits by Queen, by its very definition, is rammed with tracks that are universally popular. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, the average of all of those is quite high. So, for example, for the Queen's Greatest Hits album, Bohemian Rhapsody is week in, week out, the most streamed Queen track. Mm. But it's counting a great deal towards the chart sales of Greatest Hits because so many of the others are actually being streamed in large numbers. I mean, you have to ask yourself, Bohemian Rhapsody actually appeared on Queen's album, A Night at the Opera. Why do you not see A Night at the Opera in the album chart week in, week out as a result of Bohemian Rhapsody? Yeah. It's because none of the other tracks on the album are actually as popular. Right. So as a result, Bohemian Rhapsody's contribution to that album is far, far lower than it is for Greatest Hits. Mm. And so you'll notice that it's albums, studio albums, that have a larger than usual number of popular tracks actually are benefiting from streaming numbers. And Rumours is always one of them, because, I mean, there's about five or six very famous cuts on Rumours that are being streamed in large numbers. A&M by the Arctic Monkeys. Yeah, there's about two, three, four tracks. It was always appreciated as far and away the best Arctic Monkeys album. And the other one that's notable as well that's come for an extended wonder in the albums chart, particularly in the past year or so, is What's the Story, Morning Glory by Oasis, which again is a mini greatest hits collection in and of itself because so many of its tracks are very famous. Mm. So they're being streamed in large numbers and cumulatively they are actually ensuring it pops a fairly large number in the charts week in, week out. I mean, I say fairly large number. It's all relative. The actual numbers for albums when you get down to mid-table are not actually all that large. Mm. It's a couple of thousand copies at the most that will get you somewhere into the top 40, top 30. So you don't actually need a great deal of streams to actually make it into the lower end of the albums chart. Mm. But significantly, they are charting where contemporary albums are not. Mm. Having said that, there are some contemporary albums that have stuck around. I mean, the most notable one is Lewis Capaldi's debut, Divinely Uninspired to a Hellish Extent. Yeah. Very popular, yes, because there are a couple of big singles on there, but it can't just be because of the big singles. It must be some of all the others, because it had an extended run in the top 10. Mm. In fact, it was only at Christmas time when it was finally swamped by some of the other Christmas packages that it was actually forced out of the top 10 for the first time since it had been released. And it's still floating around there, still inside the top 20. The other extraordinary one as well, the album that you'd have thought was something of a one-week wonder, but has just refused to go away. And this has been the phenomenon of the past year, is Shoot for the Stars, Aim for the Moon by Pop Smoke,
right,
which is crazy when you think about it, because here is an album by a man who wasn't necessarily a big name before the album was released, who had the misfortune to pass away before it had been released. And so it did well when it was put out, because you thought, okay, it's a nice tribute to this man who went away. But then people actually discovered that it's a phenomenally good album and have continued to stream it in large numbers week in, week out, to an extent that most rap albums don't manage.
Yeah.
I mean, they tend to be incredibly popular when they first come out. They will be streamed in very large numbers by the kinds of people who follow these artists, but then they'll fade away to almost nothing. Pop Smoke, for whatever reason, has gone mainstream and become the listening album of choice to a large number of people. And it will be fascinating to see exactly how long that carries on for, because it's been 42 weeks now. It's still there in the top 20. It still floats into the top 10 every so often. If it's done that for all this time until now, there's no reason to assume it's not going to carry on being popular over the next couple of years or so. And there's the inbuilt, I mean, I hesitate to use the word advantage. There's the inbuilt fact as well that Pop Smoke is not in a position to make another album and steal the thunder of his first one. So it's the only Pop Smoke album he's ever actually going to make.
Yeah.
Unless they put out some, you know, unreleased material they've found on the studio floor. Mm. And that's going to be at this great enduring legacy this man has. And I think there are people in the industry who would love to know exactly what the bit of magic that possesses is to try and capture it in a bottle and to try and divert that somewhere else as well. But there's no rhyme or reason to it. There's no telling which album is going to grab people's imaginations and be streamed week in, week out for an extended period, as opposed to those which are released, which do a large number because they've sold to the fans, and then completely vanish from sight and you'll never hear them again.
Well, James, it's been really fascinating talking to you. We'd love to have you back on, actually, at some point. It was sort of something, you know, we could do like 6 months down the line or something. We'd go on forever about everything we've spoken about. But before we let you go, just wondering, is there anything, I mean, I know we've already talked about some trends we've seen in 2021, but do you think there's anything you're forecasting for 2021, anything you think we're going to see more of, whether that's like a particular artist or, I don't know, a particular way that it comes to the forefront? Bit of a difficult question, but...
it's an odd question to try and look into the future. What we're all hoping is that our lives in general are going to return to some semblance of normal as we push past having to focus on coronavirus and the pandemic and worrying about social distancing. So the big question is going to be all the parts of our lives, all the parts of the whole music ecosystem that have had to go on pause, are they going to come back in the same form? There are hopefully going to be summer festivals later on this year. Clubs may well get the chance to reopen. And people are going to, acts are going to be able to perform live again. When that happens, are we going to see a direct impact in the way songs and albums and even acts come to the forefront? Or has these societal changes that have been accelerated by the fact that we've all been forced to retreat into a virtual world, has it actually changed everything fundamentally forever? Will things return back to the way they were? And so whilst there's, you know, a great many people looking forward to being able to promote gigs again and perform at gigs and actually go to gigs, there is this big question mark of, have we actually got out of the habit of doing so? And I think the consequences of what we've been through in the past year or so are going to be with us for some considerable time to come. And maybe historians in the future will look to the way the music charts behaved and the kind of things that made it into the charts to learn the lessons of exactly how that worked. But that's why I love watching the charts. It's not necessarily talking about what's happening this week. It's being able to look back in a few years' time and say, well, we know this was happening, because look, this song was here, this song was here, this was the kind of thing that was popular, and that was the reason for it.
Definitely.
I guess one very last question for me, just so I'm interested. Have you got a favourite ever year of chart music, or of a year that stands out to you?
There do seem to be some, and I think everybody has an affection for the music that was current when they were growing up, when they were a teenager. And I always try to avoid focusing on that in particular. But yeah, every so often you get those years where you can look back and say, yes, pop music achieved perfection in that year. All I will say is there's two in this century that do stand out for me. Can't really explain why, because it's also tied into what was happening in your life at that moment as well. And how those songs spoke to you at that moment. But the hits of 2001 and the hits of 2012.
Interesting.
Okay.
They, interesting, for me, are the ones that actually stand out. But I think if you can find three other people and ask them that same question, and you'll get three different answers, because it's all very personal. But you're right to ask. There are certain years where everything just seems to click. And then when they don't the following year, you feel very let down as a result.
Definitely.
No, that's so fascinating. Yeah, really interesting.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, James. Cheers for that.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Cool. So there we have it. A lot of information there. I mean, that guy can definitely talk chart. I think we've we found today.
Talk chart.
So yeah, a lot to probably go and read after talking to James. I think I want to look at the I want to look at his backlog of all this chart data that he's got back to the 90s.
Now James is obviously working on Music Week for the last year or so. It's like a dream job, just looking into all this stuff, like different trends, whether it was like social media playing a part or something controversial, like a film, TV series that gets popular overnight. There's so many reasons for a song just blowing up. And I guess it's his job to understand why, which is so cool.
Exactly, yeah. You wouldn't really search for like a chart analyst job on LinkedIn, would you? It's like, it must be so niche, But thanks so much, James, for joining us, and thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed, do give us a like and subscribe. We're on Twitter and Instagram at MEACpod. And if you really liked it, then give us a 5-star review. That would be awesome. So, Neil, until next time.
Ciao.